Hey guys, and welcome to episode 189 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interview Mara Wilson. Mara is an actor, and you may recognize her from films such as Matilda and Mrs. Doubtfire. She's also a writer and OCD advocate. Now, I got the pleasure of meeting her at the recent ISDF conference in Texas, and it was a pleasure to speak on a panel with her. So thank you to her for agreeing to come on the show, talk to me, and share her story with you guys. So we go into all the detail of her story, you know, her recovery journey, what she's doing now, her writing, her advocacy. Thanks again to Mara for sharing her story, and I hope you find it inspiring and helpful. Now, without further ado, here she is. On the podcast today, I have Mara Wilson. Mara is an actor who you may recognize from films such as Matilda and Mrs. Doubtfire. She is also a writer and OCD advocate. Welcome to the show, Mara.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. And obviously, we spoke on a panel together at the ISDF, so that was a yes. Real honor. And also, you were the keynote speaker. So it's great to be able to share your story with my audience.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
Oh, brilliant. As you know, I love people's OCD stories. So, you know, as little as much detail as you want to give, it'd be good to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've told my story, my sort of sad story from the beginning so many times. But now there are things that I look back on that are funny or ridiculous to me now, or are things that I feel like if I knew somebody else had gone through, it would have been nice to hear as well. You know, and that I think is important, is sort of is being open about the weirder aspects of OCD and being and talking to other people about it and those kinds of things. I think that's really important, and it not always just being a sob story all of the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that. I think, yeah, I definitely tell my own story, and I know others that share their story on a regular basis. It can almost get tiring sometimes.
Yeah.
but I guess, I don't know if you find this, that you kind of change it as you go a bit, and you almost unpack things that you'd forgotten about with each telling.
Yeah, you do. And you very quickly, it's funny because things that could have taken you years in different kinds of therapy to unpack, you can now do in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
You can say, I was doing this, and it's probably because of this.
Yeah.
You know? and it is really funny to be able to have that amount of control over your narrative, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, it'd be good to just get kind of cliff notes of your story. If you don't want to kind of go into the depths of it.
Sure. Well, I was always an anxious child. I was nervous about a lot of things. I had these worry dolls when I was little, and my brothers would talk about finding me like holding them and crying. And they would ask what was wrong, and I would always say, it's just my worries again. And you know, I was 4 or 5, but it was always, it's just my worries again. So they were already happening, and it was already something that I was sort of internalizing, that worries were a thing that happened to me all of the time. I was also a very like extroverted child. I loved meeting with people. I loved performing, and I could seem like a very, very happy child when I wasn't completely anxious. You know, I wasn't introverted. I wasn't quiet. So it was, I think that was strange to people, because when somebody's kind of shy and quiet, you might expect them to be, you know, more anxious. But I was a loud overcompensating in child, I think. So that was me for a long time. And I think that I got into acting when I was pretty young. And where I grew up, child acting, I mean, it was like, you know, there are kids who play rugby, even though that might not be the safest thing to do, or American football, even though that might not be the safest thing to do. And nobody kind of bats an eye at that. And that's kind of what child acting was like where I grew up in Southern California.
Yeah.
So I started doing a little bit of that. And I think it was a wonderful experience in many ways. I have a lot of really happy memories, and you know, it made me who I am today. But I do think it also probably made it made me more of a perfectionist because on film sets, it's all about getting the right take and doing it perfectly the first time. And there's incentives to get it right the first time. And so it makes you kind of afraid to make a mistake when you're a child and to be a people pleaser. I also think that, especially as I went through puberty, it made my body dysmorphia really, really bad because I was convinced that I was ugly, and because I was ugly, I was useless. You know, I couldn't get jobs anymore. I couldn't do any of these things anymore. And, you know, it's one thing when it's just your head telling you these things, but it's another thing when you have the rest of the world, when you have the media, when you have casting directors, when you have all these other people also telling you, you are just as ugly and hideous as you think you are. So that I think was really hard. I mean, it's something that was very difficult for me. But I think the thing that set me off the most, and I think I always did have OCD. I always did have a lot of strange intrusive thoughts, but I think the compulsions and things didn't really show up until my mom was ill with cancer when I was she was diagnosed when I was 7, and I think for most of it, I was kind of in denial. And also I was busy filming the movie Matilda, which was a really sort of good environment for me and also sort of very, very, very welcoming place. And once we wrapped on that film, though, then I started washing my hands obsessively. I felt like I could never really be clean. I started obsessing about germs all the time, which, I mean, my mom had cancer. That's not, you know, anything having to do with pathogens, but still, for some reason in my head, I think it went to germs being bad. So I was washing my hands multiple times an hour. It was the first thing I did when I came home from school, and my hands were red and raw and often bleeding. They were chapped, and we would put all kinds of lotions and ointments and topical things on them, and nothing would work. I just needed to keep doing that. As I got older, I got obsessed with hand sanitizer. I got obsessed with cleaning things like you know, pocket change and all kinds of things that I had. And I it was strange because I was pretty messy. I mean, if you looked at my bedroom, there were always clothes on the floor. Things were out of order. But when it came to myself, I was terrified of, you know, getting my hair dirty or getting my hands dirty or getting my face dirty. I would obsess with that. I didn't like anybody touching me, touching my hands. I remember having to do a dance in fifth grade when I was about 10, like a square dance kind of thing, and absolutely refusing to hold the boy next to me's hand because who knew what germs he could have.
Yeah.
You know, it was this, and I felt for some reason like boys were dirtier than girls, which was
probably
not
true.
I mean, yeah, it's still not like the nicest thing to think, but no, yeah. So I would just refuse to hold their hands, to do these things, to get close to them. But as my mother got more ill, that's when I started having really bad panic attacks. I started obsessing over things like my pets, and I would like be checking on my pet hamster every hour, every night to make sure that she hadn't escaped from her cage. I would walk down the hallway and think immediately, you can't walk there. There was a mark on a doorway that I had to duck under because otherwise I felt like it was going to cut off my head. And after my mother died, I mean, it was just a haze of grief and sadness and misery and these sort of flare-ups of OCD that would come and would go. And certain songs were good luck and certain ones were bad luck. And certain songs were good luck, certain songs were bad luck, certain phrases were good luck, certain numbers were good luck, some were bad luck. I had to avoid the number 5, then I had to avoid the number 8. And I had to do this thing where I kept tapping out all of these syllables on my fingers until it would end on my little finger. And I would have to keep doing that over and over again until I ended on my little finger. And that was just kind of a self-soothing thing. As I got older, there were times I was pulling out my hair. It was a really rough ride for a really long time. And finally, when I was 12, I read a book called Kissing Doorknobs about a girl who had OCD. And I immediately knew this was what I had, and I immediately knew I wanted to get help for it. And with the help of some people who had been kind of like mentors to me, I was too afraid to tell my family. I took it to my counselors at school and said, I think I have this and I want to get help. And fortunately I did.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. Yeah. So that, That book, actually, Kissing Doorknobs, I hadn't heard of it until you mentioned it at the ISDF conference.
Yeah.
Is it still on sale now?
It is, yeah,
okay.
It is. It's a young adult book. So,
cool.
I mean, I was 12 when I read it, so I was just the right age range because it's about a 14-year-old girl who has had, you know, anxiety and obsessions and compulsions since she was about 10. But it also goes into how she, when she was a very young child, was also very worried and very scared a lot of the time. And I remember just reading it and starting to cry when I read it because it felt like it was the story of my life.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, it was actually written, I didn't realize this until much later, it was written by one of my co-stars on Matilda's mom, which is really funny because a lot of my OCD, I think, was sort of identifying patterns often where there was none. And I find it really funny that I didn't identify this very obvious pattern until much later.
Wow, yeah, what an incredibly small world.
I know.
Yeah. Okay. No, thank you for sharing your story. Before we get into kind of therapy and recovery journey and stuff like that, it was Guatemalan worry dolls, right? I know you didn't say it then, but I think from the talk I remember it. Yeah, that really, for some reason when you did the talk, it really, that image, almost the image of you there of the dolls really kind of stuck with me. And you said you were sort of about 4 or 5.
I don't even remember doing this. I do remember my worry dolls and I do remember crying a lot, but it was one of my brothers who told me that. And he said that image, he said, one of my older brothers, he said that image had stuck in his head for a really long time.
Yeah.
And I think it was something that had probably really bothered him to see me so upset, because I've always been very close with my brothers and they've always been very protective. But it also was like, you know, what could he do? You know, he was only a child and there's so much information and ignorance about OCD. You know, my parents didn't really know what it was either.
Yeah.
Even though my mother had grown up in a family with mental illness, she still didn't recognize what was happening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's tough, especially, you know, when we were, because we're similar ages.
When
we were younger, there was no internet, no, and just lots of misinformation on TV. Okay. And, you know, you talked about being a happy child, well, at least showing being a happy child. And I'm sure you were happy a lot of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't ever remember being hungry. I don't ever remember not having a roof over my head. You know, things were relatively stable.
Yeah.
So I had nothing to really be anxious about, but I always felt like I was walking on shaky ground, which I was literally sometimes because I did grow up on an earthquake fault line. but that did kind of feel like an apt metaphor for my life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And did you find yourself at times almost using that happy child as a mask? So even when you weren't happy, kind of keep almost acting effectively?
Yeah, I had to. I think I had to, but it would always come out. Every time I had a flare up, I would give myself 3 days. I would say, okay, the first day is going to be bad. The second day will be a little bit better. The third day, it'll be fine. It'll be fine again. And I could kind of repress it and push it down. And the weird thing was, I think once I actually knew that it was OCD and anxiety, I felt like I couldn't hide it anymore. And then I was crying more. I was struggling more. I was having a lot more ups and downs because I felt like I felt like something finally had me. You know, I knew what it was, and I don't know, and maybe that was just a sort of a psychological thing, but I mean, obviously it was a psychological thing, but I do think that, you know, a lot of times I would have a day where I was really anxious, where I was crying, sobbing, where, you know, I would be at camp or something. And I remember there was a thing we had to do where we had to get really dirty and messy. And I was crying and crying and crying the whole time. And I remember thinking to myself that everybody at camp was going to think that I was super weird because other than that, I was, you know, I was this girl with like a big mouth and a lot of bravado. And, you know, I was one of the cool girls and I was as tough as the boys. And then all of a sudden I was this, you know, sobbing mess because I got a little dirty. And, you know, and I kept thinking to myself, like, what are they possibly going to think of me? And so sometimes people would be like, hey, are you okay? After I would disclose my feelings or talk about my anxiety to them. And I'd be like, I'm fine. Leave me alone. It was like these almost like emotional anxiety one night stands where I would just like pour my heart out to somebody. And then I wouldn't want to see them afterward because I was so ashamed.
Yeah, and that was that before that was all before the diagnosis.
Yeah, it
Yeah.
was. And sometimes after too,
Okay, yeah.
you know, I had a lot of trouble. I also think that, you know, being a child actor and being a perfectionist, I was really afraid to let people see the real me, because I thought that they wouldn't like it. And I think that I was really afraid to let them see me as this anxious person. I felt like I'd always had to be on my best behavior, and I felt like they would think that I was crazy, that I was weird, all of these things, and I didn't want anybody to see me like that.
Yeah.
So I think that I actually struggled with that for a very long time, probably until I started doing more advocacy with OCD. I kept it. And there's still things. I think it's also very important to have boundaries and to set boundaries and to have certain things. Like there's certain aspects of my OCD I don't want to share with people
Yeah.
just because, you know, it's my business. But I also think that it's important to be open and to, you know, to own who you are.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. Yeah, I don't think if for anyone who wants to become an advocate or do advocacy, you don't need to share every single bit of your life or your
Exactly.
OCD. Just you can share
You don't.
20% and still be very effective in advocacy.
And different people have, yeah, and different people have comfort with different things. Like I
Yeah.
have friends who will post on social media, on public social media, when they have a panic attack. And that they say is something that kind of helps them. It helps them feel less alone, and they feel like it helps other people as well. And I think that's great, but I probably wouldn't do that myself. Because when I'm having a panic attack, I want to focus on, okay, how do I deal with having a panic attack and filling out my panic diary and all my coping skills and such, and later on I'll do that. So it's really up to the person, I think.
Yeah.
Disclosing doesn't necessarily mean disclosing everything, and I think that's important.
Yeah, really, really good point. Okay, cool. And you said something, I mean, this is very common to hear about afraid of telling your family when you
Right.
realized it was OCD, but you did tell the school counselor, which was great. But
Yeah.
what was the worry around telling your family?
I think that if you talk to any child who has lost a parent, or probably even children who've gone through traumatic divorces or a parent leaving, I think there's always this sort of primal fear they have that they are going to be abandoned by their family, that their parents aren't going to love them anymore. If they were, you know, if they're bad, if they're weird, if they're different, I think that that is something that they very much fear. And I think that that was something with me too. And, you know, like a lot of my other fears, I think I knew it was irrational, but I was afraid I would be separated from my family. You know, the depictions of mental illness that I had seen were things like people being locked away in psychiatric wards
Yeah.
and cut off from the rest of the world and, you know, labeled crazy and insane, which are words that don't mean anything. You know, I thought it meant isolation. And as I've said, I've always been a very social person and I've always been very close with my family. So the idea of not being able to be social and not being able to be around my family, it destroyed me. Just the thought of that worried me so much. I didn't want that ostracization, and I didn't want to. I felt almost like I would be disappointing my family and especially my dad. But I mean, my parents, you know, my family loved me anyway. I remember after I told my dad, I came home and he had a copy of Mark Summers's book, Everything in Its Place. And Mark Summers was one of the really first public advocates for OCD, I think, in the 1990s. And my dad was like, yeah, he seems like a really nice guy. And, you know, I thought you might enjoy this book. So,
Oh,
and
cool.
that really meant a lot because it showed that my dad was understanding and accepting, you know, my OCD as part of who I was. And, you know, and he gave me a hug and told me he loved me. And you know, like, obviously they just wanted me to be better. And that was how the rest of my family felt as well. They just felt like that. And I mean, anxiety also runs in my family as well. And my sister has a bit of OCD as well. And we're both pretty open about it. And while I wish she didn't have to deal with it is sometimes fun and funny to be able to joke about it together. And it is kind of nice to know that somebody understands. I
Yeah.
actually told this story at at the conference, which is one of my favorites. She was texting with me and she had been applying to transfer for a college program, and she'd been typing a lot of things on her phone. And she wrote something like, "I'm having such a basil hard day." And I was like, what do you, what? You're having a what? And she goes, oh, I'm actually really afraid that I'm secretly going to, like without even noticing it, put in a swear word in one of my applications for work or for school. So I changed all of the swear words in my phone to autocorrect to Basil. Basil is her cat. Yeah. Yeah. So she autocorrected all of the swear words to her cat's name because she was afraid that people would she was afraid that people would that she would accidentally type in, you know, the F word or something like that, and she wanted to avoid it. So instead she changed it to her cat's name, which is less offensive.
Yeah, that's a really clever way.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's, you know, there are a lot of clever compulsions out there, and we laughed about a lot about that because that is classic OCD right now, right there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, cool. No, thank you for that. Okay, so therapy. So you got diagnosed at 12. Did you do sort of therapy straight away, or did that come later on?
Yeah, I did do therapy straight away. I think that I don't really think that I knew the best ways to do therapy at that age, though. I didn't, it wasn't really structured. There wasn't a lot of CBT. So I definitely got a lot out of it, but it was a lot of it, I think, was sort of limited by, you know, my age and you know, where I was and how I was at that time. So a lot of it was sort of talk therapy. And I did see a psychiatrist as well, one who was very, very adept at working with young people. And I went on medication. And, you know, where I grew up in California, a lot of people sort of think that medication is something to be ashamed of. There's a lot of things of like, why don't you just do yoga? Why don't you just do natural cures? Why don't you just do that? And I'm here to tell you that I grew up in Southern California, so I did do those things. I did try changing my diet. I did try yoga. I did try meditation. And yeah, they helped, but they didn't, you know, nearly cure it, which is what medication did. And once I went on medication, I was able to actually do yoga and eat healthier and exercise more and things like that. So, you know, medication got me through the worst of it, and exercise and yoga and nutrition and all of those things, they helped as well. I really feel like that was very frustrating to me. I felt like there was a lot of shame around medication. I think nowadays there is less so, which is good, I think, because, you know, and yes, I mean, I'm not saying that pharmaceutical companies are heroes or anything, but I do really think that we need to focus on whatever helps people. And it's going to be different for different people. Sometimes it's medication for some people, sometimes it's not. And for me, medication helped. So that is something I definitely advocate that if that is what you want. But I mean, I've also had experiences on certain medications where I was like, oh, this isn't good for me. I'm going to go off it. And I mean, I really wish that everybody in the world had access to doctors and psychiatrists who cared about them. And, you know, the sort the ones that I've had who, if I call them and say, hey, this isn't working, they'll say, okay, I understand, and will help me out with that. And that, you know, that's a goal of mine for the future, try to make sure that everybody around the world has, you know, adequate mental health access. But, you know, that's a whole big other project.
That's a good goal. Yeah, that'll keep you busy.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. No, thank you. And then is therapy something you've kind of continued through various stages throughout your life?
Yeah, I've done therapy, and I think the kind of therapy that I've worked has worked for me the best has been sort of like there'll be a mix of CBT and psychodynamics and all of these things, you know, and talk therapy, and like there's a lot of different kinds. The therapists that I've seen usually kind of do a mix of things, and that I think has been helpful for me. I do know that I need structure in my life, and I think that has been, you know, something that has been good for me. I also have had a lot of good luck with workbooks. I had one called the Panic Attack Workbook, and it's interesting to me. This is something that happens, I think, to a lot of people with OCD. A lot of us also have the spectrum disorders as well, so it'll be OCD and also panic disorder and also generalized anxiety disorder and also trichotillomania and also depression and also body dysmorphia and all of these things. It's very rarely just OCD in my experience, and mine certainly wasn't. I had a whole other host of diagnoses, but for a long time, I think OCD was my biggest thing. But then, like when I was in college, my panic attacks got really bad, And then, you know, I had problems with generalized anxiety. And then recently my OCD has been more of a problem again. So it's kind of hard to deal with. And I do think that OCD sort of has changed. It is sort of such an internal part of myself. It really has changed. It is so it's entrenched in my mind. I feel like it does. I've had some people say that they consider OCD thinkers to be, you know, non-neurotypical just because our brains do seem to work a little differently. And I don't know if there's truth to that, but I do feel like it has OCD is part of who I am, even when my symptoms aren't that bad. But I have had a lot of luck. As I've said, I've had a lot of success working with workbooks. The panic attack workbook is one that I highly recommend to people, and it also does help with OCD and OCD flare-ups.
Yeah. Who's that by?
It's something that it's by Dr. David Carbonell. And he also has a website called anxietycoach.com, I think. And he does a lot of good belly breathing exercises that help with flare-ups. And it's all about sort of it's kind of brain lock is another great one. You know, brain lock's kind of a classic. And I think brain lock and the panic attack workbook are very much about sort of accepting your anxiety and your OCD and facing up to them and you know, and sort of doing sort of DIY exposure therapy kind of things. And seeing them as practice, really, and seeing them as good practice for when it actually happens. And that's the thing, the more you practice it and the more, you know, you keep your panic diaries and the more that you know, accept your OCD and then kind of channel your energy into something different, the more that you do that, the less scary it is. And I think that's really important.
No, I completely agree. Okay, no, thank you. And you did
I never
mention
did.
else.
I never did like the in-office exposure therapy that a lot of people did, but I did have. But you know, I mean, a lot of times when you have a lot of really mundane obsessions, you know, if you it, like, there's the thing that says like you should do something every day that scares you, and I'm just like, some of us don't have a choice. You know, that the whole world kind of becomes, you know, exposure therapy, I guess. And you can do these things, and you can do some of these things sort of on your own, and I think that that has been something that has been really helpful. Anyway, sorry, you were saying?
No, that was, thank you for sharing that. I was just going to say, so different types of therapy, medication, and then is there anything else you do even now that kind of helps you stay on top of it, or if you're having a particularly bad week, kind of try and level out a
Yeah.
bit?
I think that being open with my friends about it has been really helpful because I have a lot of friends who either have dealt with mental illness themselves or they have like friends or family members who did. So I'm lucky that I have a lot of people who understand and a lot of family members who will understand as well. Some of them are mental health or physical health, you know, experts, and so I can talk to them about these things. There's also a lot of little things that I do, things that I've learned from Brain Lock, from the Panic Attack Workbook, from different places. Like lately, I've been noticing when I'm feeling really anxious, one thing that helps is looking around me and naming three things that I can see, like describing three things that I can see, and then describing three things that I can feel. Because that I think is a really good way to ground myself. So, like, I did that the other day when I was having a panic attack. I looked up and I was like, okay, there's my lamp on the other side of the room, and you know, and there's my cat, and he's, you know, he's big and fat and he's orange, and you know, and here's my you know, and here's my favorite book, and things like that. You know, you do things like that, and this is what my hands are touching right now. My feet are on the ground. My you know, this is what I'm feeling right now, and that I think gets you more into your body and out of your head a little bit. There's worry periods, which I think are really interesting, where you schedule times just to worry, and you do your worrying out loud to a mirror. That I think is really helpful, and it does feel a little bit of reminiscent of the worry dolls that, you know, somebody gave me as a gift when I was a child. That I think is really helpful because you say your worries out loud, and they don't sound as weird. They sound a little weird at first, but you kind of get used to saying them out loud and doing them, that I think is really interesting. There's also, I think, keeping a panic diary. is really, really helpful for me. And I do it anytime I'm having a bad OCD flare up or a bad panic attack. I will just write down my thoughts, my feelings, and how I feel like I'm reacting to it, and whether or not I'm engaging with my thoughts, things like that. I think that's good for mood swings. It's good for a lot of different things. It can be good for depression as well. And you do it in the midst of these things, and it really will help you feel like you have more control. Belly breathing. I do belly breathing all of the time. I have been doing more yoga lately. And if I do just like a regular and meditation, if I do just regular meditation, I'll fall asleep. So I found some that are more like about chanting or movement or things like that. And that stuff, I think, really, really helps people and really, really can help. And yeah, and I mean, I think that there's, you know, some people pray, some people meditate, some people do these things. And I do think that it's also important to do those things once you've also already got a hold on your OCD, because they can take on a sort of compulsive nature. But I do think that that once you've done that, you know, and you sort of separated, you can do that. Lately, I've been, I think lately, one of my favorite things I've been doing is because my OCD these days is mostly a lot of internal obsessions and compulsions. It's not the physical ones, the outward ones that you would see as a child. I know some people talk about pure OCD, and I don't even know if I agree that that's a thing. But I always have had a lot of intrusive thoughts, obsessive thoughts. What if I do this? What if I'm, you know, at dinner with a friend and there's a candle on the table and I just set the table on fire? What if I do that? What if I run into traffic? What if I push somebody into traffic? What if I do this? All of these thoughts. And the way that I've sort of been coping with them is imagining, I really don't like when people use like edgy humor or shock value. You know, I think that that's really obnoxious. And so now I basically imagine that there's like this tiny edgelord in my head who's trying to be so edgy and you know, trying to shock me with all these, you know, these devious things. And I'm just like, oh, like, come on, you don't impress me. You're just a loser. You're just trying to be cool by being edgy. So really, like, they do these things and I'm like, that's the best that you've got. Go back to like a 2002 Hot Topic, you know, like, sorry that this is, you know, it's, you know, sorry that you trying to provoke and trying to shock, like, that's such a, like, a 13-year-old thing to do, you know, grow up. And that's basically how I'm dealing with the OCD thoughts now, is just like, yeah, okay, I hear you. You're obnoxious and you're boring. You're just trying to be edgy. Shut up. And it's fun. It's funny to do that, I think. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of people like that in real life who try to, you know, say or do offensive things to get attention. And that's basically the way that I'm treating it in my brain, the way that I would treat it in real life, which is, oh, shut up, you're so boring.
Yeah, I can see why that works.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Thank you for sharing. And with your, I can't remember the words you used, but we'd call it worry time.
Worry periods.
And so that's, yeah, you set a period of time, let's say it's 8 p.m. of an evening. Find that when you get to, say, that time period, that you no longer care about the things you wrote down?
Well, I usually do them in the morning.
Okay.
I think because a lot of times I'll wake up sort of anxious, and when I'm anxious, I also get irritable. And so and I don't do them every day. I probably should. It's sort of like exercising for me. It's something I'm like, OK, I know I should be doing this more. And that's another thing, too, is, you know, you're like, a lot of people I know are like, oh, yeah, I don't do my mindfulness stuff as much as I should. And that's the thing, too. Don't beat yourself up for not doing it every day. Just, you know, remember that it is good for you, that it is helpful for you. Usually I do them in the morning, but I have found that it helps because it does sort of reduce the things in my head, because I've already said them, I've already put voice to them, and I've done them out loud to a mirror, and it's not as scary anymore. And it sort of reduces it a little bit. Like, there's something cathartic about it that I really like.
Hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. So no, thank you for that. That was really useful. So what would you say, was there like a big epiphany moment or a light bulb moment in your recovery journey where something just made sense?
I don't know if there really was one moment. I think that it's been a lot of me kind of putting things together in my head. And you know, looking over my life and sort of, and I have a tendency to narrativize everything anyway. I actually do feel like my OCD in some ways has made me a better writer because, you know, you're finding the patterns in everything. You're finding the narrative in everything. You are, you know, you are trying to do this and you end up doing it. You also end up imagining a lot of worst case scenarios, which is, you know, a lot of times what you need for writing. You need higher stakes. So I don't think that I ever had one big epiphany moment other than reading Kissing Doorknobs when I was a teenager. I do think that there's been a lot of things where I stumbled upon it. And, you know, when I found the right therapist and you know, sort of reflected on the way that my childhood had been, or reflected on, you know, the life that I'd had where I felt like I was very much in the public eye and I was struggling with that. There's been a lot of epiphanies in therapy or, you know, or accepting the fact that I was not heterosexual, which was something that I tried to fight for a really long time. Oddly, I think it was because I felt like I had too much already in my life. I was like, oh, surely I can't be suffering from mental illness and also, you know, not be straight, which, as friends of mine pointed out, they were like, that doesn't make any sense. And I was like, I know it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, and I there have been things that these realizations that I've had. I don't know if there's been one big epiphany with OCD. I think it's been a lot of little things and a lot of sort of, you know, like trying to and play whack-a-mole. I don't know if you have whack-a-mole in England where, you know, something pops up out of the machine and you have to hit it and get it down and then something else pops out. So a lot of kind of trying to do that, trying to sort out all these things, figure out all these things. It's been difficult at times, but yeah, it's been a lot of little work. And there's, you know, every now and then there's two steps forward and one step back. You know, that's definitely going to happen sometimes. But I think at the very least, I'm aware and accepting of my own mental illness, and I know how it works.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And somewhat similar question is, was there a particular roadblock that sticks out for you in your recovery? And if so, how did you overcome it?
I think probably some of the roadblocks were, I think there were a lot of times where I didn't really want to face certain things. I was too afraid to. I was too afraid to face my panic attacks. I was too afraid to think of my darker, scarier thoughts about OCD. I was too afraid to not be a perfectionist. And I think that I got in my own way a lot. I think that I struggled. One of the things that I feel like I did is I would fight my OCD thoughts. I would fight my anxious thoughts all the time. And a lot of the time that makes it worse. I think it escalates it. The oh no, I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible person because I'm thinking these things, because I'm obsessing about these things. That I think is really hard. I do feel like I wish I had kind of been more proactive in fighting my depression, though. And my depression was never my first thing. I think it was more like a side effect, you know, of OCD. And I think that but I wish that I had been a bit more proactive about doing that. I also think that I was very cynical when I was young. You know, I'd experienced a lot of popularity and such as a young child. Never in school, by the way. I was never popular in school, but popularity on a nation and even global scale. And I think I was very jaded. And then, you know, with my mother dying, you know, your parents, having a parent die, it changes you. It changes you just irrevocably. And I can't say that there was like, you know, I don't know when it happened, but there was just for so long, I was so cynical and I just didn't want to be open to doing it. And I've heard sometimes that happens with people, like with people who are struggling with, you know, addiction and mental health issues. Sometimes it's hard because you have to sort of accept that you're powerless. And that is very hard. That is a very hard thing to do. And I think that maybe it was similar with me for a long time, was I was getting in my own way and I was fighting it because I didn't want to accept how much power my, you know, disorders had over me.
Yeah,
I think that cynicism and being cynical about it and thinking I'm never getting treatment, I'm never getting help, I'm never doing any of this, none of this is good, why do I even bother? I think cynicism is the worst and I hate it. And it's something that I have to fight in myself. But yeah, I definitely think that made things much worse and that set me back.
Yeah, no, good point. Okay, so you've been doing a lot with advocacy in recent years, for both mental health generally and OCD specifically. I guess just general question, you know, what's that been like?
It's been great. I mean, at the IOCDF conference, I felt like I was in a place where I didn't have to explain myself to anybody, which was really wonderful. I felt like if I was having a hard day and I needed to go back to my room and sleep or needed to go back to my room and cry, nobody there would think it was weird. They would just be kind of like, yeah, okay. And the rest of the world isn't like it. And it like that. And it kind of makes me sad that they're not. But I think that really felt incredible, being part of that and being able to do these things and learning so much about myself in that space. I think that was really just a wonderful experience. I think that it's been good. I mean, I feel like since I played Matilda, who was this iconic part that a lot of people look up to, you know, that's always been a big responsibility for me, playing somebody that so many people look up to and having to kind of live up to her legacy myself. So because of that, I think I've had this burden on myself to sort of try to be something of a role model. My sister says that I'm kind of a big sister to the world. And I think that that's something that I take very seriously and I want to try to do. So I want to try to be that for other people, and I want to try to guide them to it. And I've had people say, your book was my kissing doorknobs. Your book helped me get treatment for my OCD. And I mean, there really isn't a better feeling than that, because I think of the really lost, scared little girl and knowing that she could empower people, you know, knowing not only that she would get better one day, but that she could help people on her own. I mean, her biggest wish was to help people. Her biggest wish, the thing that she obsessed about the most was hurting people or not being helpful enough. So the idea that I can do that, it feels amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And quick plug, what is your book called?
My book is called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame.
Cool. I'll put the link in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
No worries. What's it been like doing it with, like, you know, the big news channels and stuff like that and TV shows?
A lot of places are, I think they're more understanding and more respectful than they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago when I was really suffering. I think that they kind of realize what it is. And so it's not this like sort of horrifying mystery illness where they talk about how horrible it is that we have to do all our compulsions over and over again and all of these things. I think people have understood that they know that it's not a joke. And they know, but they also know that it's not this like big dangerous thing, because it's not this big dangerous thing that people need to be isolated for, things like that. I think they understand now a little bit more about what it is. So some places are more sensitive than others. And a lot of places, if they don't really understand stuff about mental health, it can get kind of emotionally exhausting, because it feels like they're just wanting me to sort of share my stories over and over and over again. And, you know, some of my darkest stories. And the thing is, I think that's where boundaries comes in. And I also think it's important to be careful with myself to do that. But I also think that there are a lot of people, especially there's like an entire generation of writers who came up knowing that they had anxiety. And I've met a lot of like reporters who are like, yeah, I have anxiety as well. I have OCD as well. And that, I think, has been really helpful. And so that's something that's good. I think that things are getting better.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And yeah, like you said, the more people like yourself and other people that advocate in the mainstream media are going to change and direct that narrative, which is great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So what words of hope do you have for people with OCD?
I think it's never as weird as you think it is. or you're not too weird for treatment.
Yeah.
You're not, your thoughts, your actions, your compulsions, nothing is too strange or too weird or too beyond that, too beyond getting help. That, I think, is a thing. I think also know really that you're not alone, and also know that there are so many other people out there who have this illness, and that there's a good community of people who are going to understand you. That, I think, is good. Know your own boundaries, know what you can, and you know, don't feel comfortable sharing know that stuff, know yourself very well. I think that is really important. And yeah, I think, and also I think try to enjoy, or not enjoy, but appreciate the little fringe benefits that come with having OCD. I do think that there are some. I mean, and it's not just because, I have funny stories about the time that, I thought I had scurvy or the times, that I did, a wild thing to get out of trouble or something like that because I was so obsessed or so anxious. It's not just funny stories like that. It's also, I think that OCD does give you kind of a unique perspective on the world, and we need people who see the world in a different way. And it can make you a much more careful person, I think. So try to, accept yourself as who you are with OCD. And yeah, I think that's really important. But yeah, I think you're never as weird or as alone as you think you are.
No, absolutely. Okay, so a couple weirder questions towards the end is so I've got a time traveling phone and you can pick it up and call your 20-year-old self. What would you tell her?
Oh, my 20-year-old self, I would tell her to be more proactive about mindfulness and panic attacks. I would tell her that her 30s are way better than her 20s. yeah, I would tell her that it's okay to be scared, but she needs to accept that she's scared and accept that she's an anxious person. And that's something that people told me, but I think that I didn't really believe.
Yeah, it's one of those things you kind of have to learn, right? As with most advice, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And you've got a billboard in the area that you live. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Let's see. Oh, that's a really good question. I
It's the
mean, for me, it would
hardest
probably
question.
be for me, it would probably be something like keep breathing because sometimes I forget to breathe. but yeah, I think it's I mean, I could do some kind of OCD advocacy and say like, you wouldn't say that's so jaundice. You wouldn't say that's so diabetes. Don't say that's so OCD. Something like that, perhaps. I also think, yeah, maybe just you're never as alone as you think you are. Something like that. I think is those are a couple different options. Let's go with a couple different options. I'm as with a lot of other OCDers, I'm bad at making decisions.
It's okay, I can give you a few billboards.
Yeah.
okay, cool. Was there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared today?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I've definitely shared some of the weirder things that that I've done, and I think a lot of things also. I do think that using humor and using can sort of help to do these to make things a little bit better, but only do that stuff when you're ready, I think. Yeah, no, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground and it's been great.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Mara, and giving your time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you. It's really been a pleasure. And thank you so much for doing this.
So there you have it. Thanks a lot to Mara, and all the show notes will be at theocdstories.com. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.